So today is Cheese Fair Sunday. It is our last Sunday, the last day before Great Lent begins. And so this morning what I'd like to do is talk about some of the things that characterize Lent practically that we're going to be doing in the next few days, and talking about how to keep the first week of Great Lent well. Because if we make a good beginning, we're better. Better are the chances of making a good ending as well. So, among the things that characterize Great Lent, one of the things that characterizes it, is of course the prayer of Saint Ephrem the Great, which we'll say for Lent the first time today at Forgiveness Vespers. We actually were able to use the prayer of Saint Ephrem last Wednesday evening for Vespers. Because during Cheese Fair Week, there's still, of course, Wednesday and Friday are traditionally fasting days. But what do you do when you're already halfway fasting anyway in order to make the days a little more penitential? And so the fathers have set out that on Wednesday and Friday of Cheese Fair Week, those days actually sort of partake of some of the characteristics of Great Lent by attraction. And so on Wednesday evening, the ending of Vespers is the Lenten ending, complete with the prayer of St. Ephrem. So we got to say it Wednesday night. And had we served Vespers on Friday evening, we would have got to do it again. The prayer of St. Ephrem is a brief prayer that is said at, I think, every single Lenten service, except Divine Liturgy, throughout the course of 40 days. It's a brief prayer. St. Ephrem, by the way, he is in the... that's St. Isaac the Syrian who's over there. I was going to say he's in the confessional, but it's St. Isaac who's over there. He was a 4th century saint. He knew St. Basil the Great and Gregory of the theologian. And his prayer is brief. It consists of three sentences. O Lord and Master of my life, take from me the spirit of sloth, faint-heartedness, lust of power, and idle words. We make a full prostration on the ground. But give rather the spirit of chastity, humility, patience, and love unto me your servant. We make another prostration on the ground. Yea, O Lord and King, grant me to perceive my own transgressions and not to judge my brother. For blessed are you unto ages of ages. And we make a third prostration on the ground. Sometimes, like particularly during the hours, if we would do the third and sixth hour, say on weekdays, if we did them on Wednesday before pre-sanctified, if we did the ninth hour before pre-sanctified, sometimes the prayer of St. Ephrem is then accompanied by 12 bows. O God, cleanse me a sinner. O God, cleanse me a sinner. And we just make 12 bows. If you go to the Pan-Orthodox Vespers on Sunday evenings during Lent, and I hope you can get to some of them, at least if they're close to you, you'll see at the end of that Vespers, because it's Vespers for Monday, the clergy will say the prayer of St. Ephrem at the end of Vespers. We'll make three prostrations. We'll bow 12 times from the waist. And then they'll say the prayer once through with a final prostration at the end. And you're free to do that, you know, at home. When you say your rule of prayer at home, feel free to say the prayer of St. Ephrem as well as part of it. Okay, you can do it once through with three prostrations, but, you know, at least do that much. But that's one of the characteristic things. I try to indicate sort of as a visual clue to people when prostrations are coming up in the services. I will step down one step from the top of the ambon because it's just a little easier investments for me to get up and down if I kneel onto the step there. So if you see me, I'll do this. I'll come out. I will step down because when we do Forgiveness Vespers today, I'll do that. There are also some other verses towards the end of Forgiveness Vespers that are characteristic of the Lenten observance of Vespers, where there are three troparia that involve prostrations as well. So I'll invite you to make prostrations at that time. I'll probably remind you before the service, when it comes time for prostrations, I know you are very constrained in those chairs there and you don't have the freedom to move. In this case, those of you who are limber and are able, I invite you to go out into the aisles or the central aisle to where you can actually get up and down and to make a prostration. I know it's tile there and not very much carpeting, but I think you can manage it. In this case, very often I'll tell people, you know, please take the cues from the older people in the church because they've been Orthodox all their lives and they know what they're doing and generally their observance is good. But in the case of prostrations, people get old and stiff and they don't move so well anymore. So you'll see, if you're old and stiff, feel free to use the little kneeling pad there that's, you know, attached to the chair in front of you. But I encourage you instead, if you're able, please go out. Don't shortchange yourself. Kneeling on the little kneeling pad and, you know, devoutly bowing our heads like this is a very fine Roman Catholic gesture, and it's not an Orthodox gesture, okay? The Orthodox, we get down on our faces. That is an Orthodox gesture. So I encourage you to good observance whenever you're possible. So if you can get up and down, by all means, move to a place where you can get up and down, all right? You do that. Forgiveness vest. Oh, and if there are questions or observations or anything, of course, you know, raise your hand. You know, interrupt me anytime. The forgiveness vespers is simply the first vespers for Lent, which we'll celebrate right after liturgy, because it's easier to keep people here than it is to ask people to travel back from as far away as they live, very often, to come back in the evening for the vespers service. It's characterized, the first part of Vespers is exactly the same as all other Vespers. When we come to the entrance, we make the entrance with the censer, we sing Gladsome Light, like we always do, and then instead of the usual prokimenon, there is a great prokimenon with a couple of extra verses. At the end of the great prokimenon, we'll close the curtain, and at that point, the altar servers and some other helpers will remove all of the white cloths that are here to reveal the dark-colored cloths that are underneath. The clergy and the altar will change from gold vestments into purple vestments, and then so that when the curtain is opened again, lo and behold, we're in Lent. And at that point, the choir will begin using the Lenten melodies for the litanies, and we'll conclude Vespers in the Lenten manner, with the special verses, with prostrations, with the prayer of St. Ephrem, as well as at the end of the service. So, during the course of Vespers, there will be two sets of three prostrations for you. All right? And then, at the very end of the service, we have the rite of mutual forgiveness. I was reading something online this last week that suggested that this is a fairly recent practice in the church, at least in congregations. You know, while that may be, I don't really know the history of the rite of mutual forgiveness as it's done in parishes. I do know that it is a daily practice in monasteries and has been done in monasteries since time immemorial. I've seen this myself whenever I've been at dinner in monasteries, particularly down at St. Gregory Palamas when I was in Ohio and was able to go to confession much more regularly to my spiritual father, who's the abbot down there. I would go in the afternoon, I would do Vespers, I'd stay for dinner. Right after dinner, amidst all of the dirty dishes, they would stand up because there was an iconostasis on the wall in the dining room, and they would just all face the wall, and they would do little Compline, the after-dinner prayer. And at the end of that, they would go ask forgiveness of each other and ask forgiveness of the abbot and receive his blessing, and everybody would go to bed, and I would go home. So, in fact, when we get to... What is it? When do we do Little Compline? I'm trying to remember when we do Little Compline, but there is a few times in the course. Maybe we do that when we do the Paroclesis service. Maybe we said Paroclesis in small Compline. But at the end of Compline, when we do that, some of you have been here for that, when the priest makes a prostration and asks forgiveness of the congregation makes a prostration to the priest and asks forgiveness. So the practice of mutual forgiveness is quite ancient. But I guess doing it in congregations the way we're going to do it today has only been done in the last couple of hundred years. But it's a good thing to do. And what the reason that we do it is because whenever we have offenses one towards another, whenever our hearts are not right, these are chains on our hearts. These are burdens that we carry. And it's impossible to run the course of the fast quickly and freely if we are burdened down because our heart is offended with someone else. Or, as Scripture says, if you know that your brother has something against you, you leave your gift at the altar and you go and be reconciled with your brother. Okay? So maybe you have perfect equanimity and you're at peace with everybody in the entire congregation, don't have anything against anybody. That's fine. The rest of us are not so good. And maybe we have something against you. And so maybe we need to ask your forgiveness. Okay? And so we'll do this, and we'll do it. You'll see how at the end, those of you who have been here for those of you who are new, I will make a brief public confession. I'll make a prostration on the ambon and ask forgiveness of the congregation in general. And then we will do it individually, and I'll step down to the bottom of the stairs. and the altar servers will come first. We'll make a prostration on the ground in front of each other. We'll say, forgive me, brother, forgive me, sister, forgive me. And then we'll exchange the kiss of peace, and that person will stand to my right. And then we'll greet the next one. We'll make a prostration. That person will go to the person to my right. They'll make a prostration to each other and then add. And so we'll make a little chain of people all the way around the church here. Okay? And that way everyone will have opportunity to ask forgiveness individually of everybody else in the congregation. And you think, oh, well, I don't know who a lot of these people are. Well, that's fine. Maybe that's what you need to ask forgiveness about. But I tell you what, when your husband or your wife or your kids or your parents come up and you have to make a prostration in front of them and ask their forgiveness, suddenly the rubber hits the road and you realize just how meaningful and important this really is. It's always that case. It's always that way. So this is a fine thing, and it's one of the best parts of the year. You will find afterwards that having done that, your soul will just soar. Your soul will just soar. Because we don't always, we're not always conscious. We forget sometimes the offenses and even small things, that don't really register. But sometimes maybe they leave a mark on our heart. And when we can ask forgiveness of everybody and get rid of those things, you'll see how much better you will feel afterwards. So it's a beautiful thing. And while we're doing this, we'll probably let the choir come first, or I don't know when the choir is going to come in and do. Very often they'll run first so that they can be the first ones done and they go back, because traditionally, while we're asking forgiveness of each other, the choir will sing one of the great hymns from Pascha. Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered. Behold, this is the day of resurrection. So that we know where it is we're going. We know why we're able to ask forgiveness of each other, because Christ has already forgiven everything. And by his resurrection, everything has been redeemed. So it gives us while we're asking forgiveness of each other, we get a glimpse of where we're headed 40 days from now and where it all ends. When, after the Paschal Liturgy, we'll greet each other again. Not asking forgiveness this time, but greeting each other with Christ is risen. And knowing that indeed our salvation is secure. Okay? So, the greeting at the beginning of Lent and the greeting at the Paschal Liturgy sort of make a bracket that holds the entire Lenten observance together. It's the way of beginning it, and it will be the way to end it. Okay? So we will do that today. Also appointed during the first week of Great Lent is the great canon of St. Andrew of Crete. St. Andrew lived in the 7th century. He wrote this lengthy and beautiful composition that is a series of meditations, mostly on the Old Testament, but with a few from the New Testament, in which he goes through and he looks at characters and events in the course of salvation history, and he applies them all to himself. I've told you this before in sermon. The spiritual man, when he reads the scripture, applies everything to himself. And that's what St. Andrew did. So he will look through, for example, I remember he'll talk about Abraham fleeing the city of Sodom, when he took his nephew Lot out of Sodom. And he says, don't look back. Oh, Lot's wife looked back and she turned into a pillar of salt. You, oh my soul, are always looking back at your own sins. Okay, lesson learned. Don't look back at those things. Abraham fled from the carnality of Sodom and he took refuge in the city of Zoar. Where, O Lord, where, O my soul, are you taking refuge? You likewise taking refuge. And so he applies all these stories to himself. They're a great summary of the Old Testament, and with each little verse that's this brief meditation or reference to the scriptures, afterward is a refrain, have mercy on me, O God, have mercy on me. And this is opportunity for us either to make prostration to God and ask his forgiveness, or to bow, cross ourselves and to bow. But the whole service, if you want to learn how to repent, come to the Great Canon. And this is how you repent. Sometimes people think you have to work yourself into some emotional froth or something, or pull your heartstrings, repenting means feeling bad about yourself. It really doesn't. I mean, if you have things you need to repent of, yeah, you ought to have a conscience. You ought to feel bad about those things. But the whole purpose of Lent is not to spend 40 days in depression, or self-recrimination. It's rather to look at ourselves and say, oh, Lord, look how far I've fallen. But do you, O Lord, have mercy on me? And to keep one eye on Christ, to keep one eye always on Pascha, to know the end towards which we're going. This is for self-improvement. This is to look at our lives, not to wallow in self-pity, but in order to say, oh, I've looked under the hood and I need to change these things and get these things right. Here's a season for me to begin to do that. Here's a season where, oh, look, I spend too much time in front of the television. I spend too much time on social media. You know, I don't realize it, but, you know, I've gotten up to drinking 5 cups of coffee a day. Maybe that's really not good for me. Maybe I can cut back just a little bit. You know, or like I've jokingly told you before, you know, I'm one of those people who will, you know, will get bored and suddenly find myself in the cupboard before I realize where I am. You know, looking for corn chips, which are, you know, my comfy food of choice. You know, so you say, no, it's a fasting season. No, I don't have to self-medicate with food. Or you learn that in point of fact, you're not really hungry. You are medicating with food. Oh, I need to feel better, so I got to have a little chocolate. Oh, I'm anxious, so-and-so hasn't called me, and next thing you know, you've got the bag of peanuts and you're at it. No. Or, oh, I wonder what's going on in the world. Somehow the world can't turn unless I turn on the television and check the news. You realize, no, the world would get on just fine. It's we ourselves that are somehow slaves to our bellies, slaves to our media, slaves to our electronic devices, slaves to all kinds of other things. And this is not the freedom and the abundance that Christ promised us. So use Lent to discover the kinds of things that in point of fact you are slaves to. And you can begin to undo that bondage and to find your freedom. Okay, coffee's fine, you know, but if it takes you 5 cups in the morning to get going, you know, maybe you're not living really right. Maybe you really do need more sleep, you know, something like that. So, you know, use it as a, this is for your improvement, you know, not to, you know, not to be the big season of, you know, the big purple downtime, you know, every year, but the opportunity to correct ourselves and to make ourselves better so that we can lead the optimal lives that Christ has called us to lead and to lead the abundant lives that he wants us to have. So, but the Great Canon is a beautiful service, so I encourage you, come to at least one of them. The Great Canon is so long that in the first week we only do 1/4 of the canon on each night and set it within within Little Compline. So we'll start Little Compline, we'll do 1/4 of the canon, and then we'll finish Little Compline. Then Tuesday night we do the 2/4. Wednesday night we're going to do Presanctified, so we're just going to skip the 3/4. And then Thursday night we're going to do the last quarter of the Great Canon. So if you come more than one night, the verses of the canon, the meditations in them, will all be different each night, so you can get something out of it each time. But if you have the time, I encourage you to come for the Great Canon. On Wednesday evening, of course, we have Presanctified Liturgy. For those of you who have not been through Great Lent before, the weekdays of Great Lent, the Church has decided, are non-liturgical days. That is, we do not celebrate the Divine Liturgy Monday through Friday during Great Lent. Only on Saturday and Sunday do we celebrate the liturgies. So what do we do in the early Church for Christians who used to come to communion more than once a week, more than on just Sunday? Because in the early Church, people very often went to communion Saturday and Sunday when there were liturgies, as well as on saints' days during the course of the week. And so the Church, traditionally, of all people, Pope St. Gregory the Great is the one who is credited with putting together the Liturgy of the Presanctified. And it begins as Vespers, and then again after the entrance, after Gladsome Light, there are a couple of Old Testament readings. And then at that, it sort of shifts into the latter part of a liturgy. We have a great entrance, but this time, because the gifts have already been sanctified on Sunday, in fact, there are 2 lambs on the chalice today, one for today's liturgy, one for Wednesday's Presanctified. So because the lamb is already sanctified, there's no anaphora. We don't have to bless it again or consecrate it. So it's just carried at a great entrance, which is done in silence. A very beautiful service, the Presanctified. And then we do sort of the last part of the liturgy and we receive communion. The Presanctified liturgy itself uses some different melodies. It's a very beautiful service. We do sing the entire selection from the Psalter that's appointed to be sung on Wednesday evenings, which they do in the monasteries anyway. But this is the part, if you've been here before, in my distress I cry to the Lord that he may answer me. You know, we sit and we sing all of these psalms, and which a lot of people really enjoy. And I know Laura was always looked forward to that. That was the best part of Pre-Sanctified. She just loved that melody and loved singing the Psalms. But if you're going to come to communion, I need to ask you to fast from at least before noon on Wednesday. All right? So if you can't make it all day until dinner after Pre-Sanctified, have something for breakfast. But don't have breakfast and then have lunch, you know, and then come and just have a late dinner. That's not really fasting. I need you not to eat from at least 12 o'clock on, and if you're going to come to the chalice that evening. But come and receive Holy Communion on Wednesday night, and bring a passing dish, a Lenten dish. We always have potluck after Pre-Sanctified, because everybody's starving anyway by that time. And it is always a great way to learn something new to eat for Great Lent, because someone will have something that's positively delicious there that you never thought about before, and you'll want to say, what is that? How did you do that? And all, and it gives us greater variety, you know, in Lent, and we learn how to cook something that we, you know, something to add to the repertoire, so we're not eating the same sort of thing all the time. I tell people, you know, the first year I kept Great Lent when I was a catechumen, I lived on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and salad because I didn't know what else to eat, and it was years before I could face a piece of lettuce again after that. You know, PB&J, you know, men eat their body weight in peanut butter, I think, every so often, so you know, you never get tired of that. But salad, it was a long time, and you shouldn't get to where you hate something that you typically like because that's all you're eating. There's a lot more to Lent. If you don't know what to eat, talk to me. Talk to anybody else in the parish. There are all kinds of resources out there. And thank God for our for all of the vegans running around nowadays. The supermarkets are full of vegan things, and even most restaurants, I've begun checking the last several weeks, almost every restaurant out there has got some sort of vegetarian selection. So you can still, you know, if you want to go out, you can still go out. If you need a quick hint, you know, if you really need a fast food fix, Burger King has a veggie burger. I know you go because you really want the French fries. I know that. But you know, if you need an excuse to get a large Burger King fries, they do have a veggie burger, and you can get that with it. And sometimes that's just what the day needs, and it takes the edge off, you know, when you're pushing the fourth or fifth or the sixth week of Great Lent, and this is getting really old and really tired, and you just feel like you need to cut loose. Something like that, you know, can sometimes be exactly what you need and somehow makes it easier to get through the rest of it. All right. Beyond that, how much time do I have?
10 minutes.
I got 10 minutes. All right. I did put a number of notes in the bulletin this week. Actually, I put a lot in. I have a whole 2-page spread this time, which is usually more than I'm capable of churning out. But it talks about the things to do for the first week of Great Lent. Again, tonight we're off to have ice cream at Guernsey Dairy. They do know we're coming. So if we descend on them in dozens and whatnot, they will be prepared for us. If you can't come to Guernsey, if you live too far away or your schedule just doesn't allow it, go get some cheesecake somewhere. You know, go drive through Dairy Queen or something. Get a milkshake, but do something, to celebrate and to have one last kind of brief hoorah before the great fast is upon us. It's always a little sweeter when you make a something special out of it. But I will be at Guernsey Dairy. Excuse me? 6:30 tonight. After dinner. You know, this is for dessert. So, have your dinner and then come out for ice. You know, unless you really want ice cream for dinner. Which, you're welcome to do that. And I'm not going to judge you if you do. Okay? But after that, let's try to keep the first week of Lent very strictly. As I said at the beginning, if we make a good beginning, it's easier to come to a good end. The first week is always kept very strictly. The first day of Lent tomorrow is called Clean Monday. In the monasteries, they don't eat anything on Clean Monday. Okay, but also in the monasteries, they don't work at all during the first week of Lent. Did you know that? Yeah, the monks, they just stop all of the obediences. Only essential things get done. And they spend their time in prayer and in services and usually a lot of time alone in their cells. Okay? So for the rest of us, who have to work 9 to 5 and don't have the privilege of sitting in our cells all day, It's probably a little much to ask that we don't eat anything. But like I ask you very often on strict fast days, if you can, get by without cooking. Make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Have a salad. Have some fresh fruit. Give the kids orange juice. Bread and water for those of you who want to be, you know, just ascetical. Like I say, smear a little peanut butter and jelly on it. That's fine. Get yourself some hummus or some baba ganoush or some tabbouleh or something. You know, but you know, if you can, make something very light and easy so you don't have to spend time in the kitchen and a lot of time clean up. Just, you know, mark the day with a much simpler meal if you're able to do that. Okay. If I strongly recommend that you turn off your social media as much as possible. Get off of Facebook. Turn off the television. Try not to be glued to your mobile affirmation device, your cell phone, all the time. It will require some self-discipline. I know those things are designed to be addictive. If you haven't figured that out already, and so it will, you know, you will probably feel a little anxious if you turn it off and wonder what to do with yourself. You can find other things to. You know, no, don't hit the Doritos. That is not the thing to do if you're not looking at Facebook. See, that will be the temptation. Watch and see where your heart inclines, where your hands go, you know, when you give up one of your usual pastimes, and you will see what the kinds of things that you don't do freely, but that you do out of compulsion and thoughtlessly in order just to make yourself feel good. So watch for those sorts of things this week. Like I say, if you have children and you've agreed that the kids need to turn off some of this stuff, be sure and go over that with them again today before Lent starts, so that it's not just, oh, Lent has begun, and you snatch their cell phones. You're just going to cause a huge fight, and that's not the way really to start great Lent. You know, if you've come to some agreement, just be sure that, you know, that the kids are on board and they know what's expected, and it will be good. Let me see. We talked about the great canon pre-sanctified confession. Yeah, do come to confession sometime during Great Lent, please. It is a penitential season, and so as one of the four penitential seasons in the course of the church's year, it's a good time to come to confession. Pious folk, I encourage you, you know, come early in Lent, and then if you want to, come again towards the end of Great Lent. That's not a bad thing to do. I'm available for confession after every service. If you want to come before a service, or at any other time, you know, if after a service doesn't suit your schedule, call me. I usually have free time during the week. We can find a time that's convenient. I just don't like people to show up like right before liturgy or right before Vespers and want to confess, because when people come to confession, they're opening their hearts to God, and this is a holy moment. And I don't like to rush it, and I don't, you know, I want to give you as much time and be as respectful of you and your confession and all as possible. And, you know, if you show up, if I look out here and there's someone 5 minutes before liturgy, sort of a quickie confession, never sits well with me. Okay, I don't want to do that to you. So if you want to come before a liturgy, that's fine. Just let me know in advance, and then I can make time for you. In fact, I have one coming this morning. But, you know, she emailed me last night, and we're all good and cool with it, so I made sure I have everything done, and I have time, you know, to give to her. So that she can make a good confession. All right, so that's the only thing I ask with that. But do make a time to come at least once, sometime during the course of the Great Fast. Don't put it off to Holy Week. Holy Week is exhausting for me, and I had people in my last parish who thought that it would be really cool to confess on Good Friday after the Friday night service when Father Michael has not eaten at all day long. And he's already been standing in church for about 32 hours at that point, and had, you know, 5 dozen young people ready to go tomb hopping and all. And, oh, Father, I want to confess. You know, and I'm sort of reeling on my feet. You know, and I've told them no. Don't wait till Holy Week. I can't accommodate you during Holy Week. It's just too much to do. So please come to confession during Great Lent, if you would, please. One other thing that I'll encourage you to do, and I put it in the bulletin, I'll go ahead and mention it here, is that penitential discipline in the church always involves sexual abstinence as well. You may remember when Moses received the tablets of the law on Mount Sinai, he came down and told the people, he said, sanctify yourselves against the third day. Husbands, do not go into your wives. So before the people gathered at the foot of the mountain for the revelation on Sinai and the giving of the law, they spent 3 days in sexual abstinence. This was also done in times of warfare, because warfare was actually kind of a sacred undertaking as well. You may remember that's why when King David got Bathsheba pregnant and recalled Uriah from the front, her husband, and said, oh, here, you should go and, you know, and go into your wife, you know, and so that the child would be thought to be Uriah's, not David's. And Uriah says, no, I'm at war. How can I do that? I can't go in. So next night he got him drunk and tried to send him home, you know, drunk, and he wouldn't go home to his wife. And so David, you know, that's why David sent him back to the front lines and had him killed, you know, so that he could marry Bathsheba then. All right? But the point is that even in warfare, there were times when men did not go in to their wives. And this is what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians. I put the quote in there for you. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where in the Old King James it said, defraud ye not one another except for a time, which is totally incomprehensible to us nowadays. You know, what are we defrauding each other of? The more recent translation is, do not deprive one another except with consent for a time. What are you depriving each other? Husbands and wives depriving each other of intimacy is what he's talking about. Don't do it except with consent, mutual consent, and for a time. And for a little while, that you may give yourselves to what? To fasting and prayer. Okay? And come together again so Satan doesn't tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Well, he must be speaking to me. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. So this is something that if you are married, that, you know, it's something to talk over with your spouse. And if it's something that you are able and willing to do, then I encourage you to go the first full week of Great Lent, you know, and be abstinent. You know, after the first week, okay, you know, if you need to get back together, that's fine. But what I'd encourage you to do then is the first week of Great Lent to keep very strictly. And then the middle week of Great Lent, the week that starts with the Sunday of the cross, be abstinent that week as well. So that'd be the first week off, 2 weeks on, I guess. The fourth week off, 2 weeks on, and then Holy Week again, to be abstinent. I don't know how anybody can have sex during Holy Week, you know, when you're fasting and praying all the time. I don't know how that happens. But that would give you like 3 weeks over the course of Lent in which to be abstinent. And it really works very well. It very much marks the time. You know you're in a penitential season too, but it also gives you some insight as to how free you are with your intimacy and how much, you know, we, especially men, can be slaves to that and how much we are not free, you know, with our urges and our desires. So I encourage you, again, talk to your spouse about that. You know, this is not something for wives to say, oh good, I can get them off of me for a week. You ain't getting any. This has to be a mutual decision, okay? Because I don't want angry husbands coming to me with recrimination. She won't let me near her. And it's your fault. No, I said mutual agreement, you know, for this sort of thing. It's time. Okay. The last point that I would just that I mention here is there are traditionally in different areas pan-Orthodox services during Great Lent. There are always Sunday evening Vespers. They're at different churches around the community. This year, Sunday of Orthodoxy is way up in Sterling Heights, which is a little remote. But I know the others are a little more accessible, and I know the Sunday of St. Mary of Egypt, the last Sunday of Great Lent, is at St. Mary's Basilica over here in town. So there are some that are close. I know some of you live over on the east side. If you can get up to, you live on the east side, get up to Sterling Heights and, you know, go and attend that service, you know. But it's always good to get out and see other churches, to see other Orthodox Christians, to know that, no, we don't, you know, the way we do it at home at HTOC is not the only way that things are done. And to get out and to see, oh yeah, there are in fact other Orthodox Christians other than just ourselves out there. And it's good. We realize we're not alone. There are more of us than we think there are. And it's a beautiful thing to get together, as it says in the Psalms. You know, it's a beautiful thing for brethren to dwell together in unity and to bear witness to our common Orthodox faith. To worship together is a good thing. So that's some reflections or some things to consider here at the beginning of Great Lent. Any questions, comments, or thoughts? Not a thing. I've done an excellent job again. So I've answered all the questions before you even had a chance to ask them. One, yes. Yes, the Pan-Orthodox services, I think they are in the bulletin. They should be there. It's the page that's, it looks like this. Yeah, a couple of pages further back from my stuff. Yeah, so up there, Sterling Heights, and then St. Peter and Paul Church down in Dearborn Heights, and then in Redford on the Sunday of the Cross, and then up in Troy, I guess, is the fourth one. And then the last one is here at St. Mary's Basilica on March 25th. So, yeah, so there's a couple or three of them that are fairly close here. So, yeah, to get to those. And they always have refreshment afterwards, so it's a nice chance. You know, they got Lenten cookies and a little coffee, so you can just hang and meet people. It's good. Yes, sir?
Why do we change from the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom on Sundays to St. Basil of Great
Lent? St. Basil's liturgy is served on the Sundays of Great Lent because the anaphora is longer, I guess. Why they use it during Lent, I don't know, except that I think the liturgy of St. Basil is the older liturgy, that St. John Chrysostom's is an abbreviation of St. Basil's. And so for it's a common principle in liturgical practice that wherever anything is more elaborate or longer, it's usually the older observance. And so for Great Lent, we go back to an older anaphora for it. Also, like I said, during Great Lent, liturgy is prescribed on Saturdays and Sundays. So John Chrysostom's liturgy is served on Saturdays, and St. Basil's liturgy is served on Sundays. So when we have the memorial liturgy here in a couple of weeks' time on Saturday morning, that'll be John Chrysostom's liturgy. Okay? Yeah. All righty. Yes, Ms. Elaine.
When you go through a great mapping, are you talking about going
to... No, when I talk about tomb hopping, I'm talking about going to other churches on Great Friday evening to venerate the tombs that they set up in the center of their churches. Yeah. There are several churches around... We ain't going to the cemetery. We're going to other churches and to visit their tombs. Yeah, and we'll go and sing. We'll venerate their tombs. We'll sing a hymn while we're there. And it's a nice way to make a pilgrimage. The kids love it. In the middle of the churches. You know, like on Good Friday when we put the tomb up in the center of the church. You know, all Orthodox churches do that. And many of them stay open all night the way we do, and keep vigil at the tombs. So since they're open, we're going to go and visit their churches. Yes. Yeah, the Plashtunitsa goes in at Pascha. But on Good Friday, it's still there in the center of the church. And a lot of places keep vigil all night. We do. Someone will be here, you know, 24 hours reading the Psalms. Other churches do that. So since they're open, we'll go and visit. And the young people just love it. So it's a good time. I invite you to come. I think we had at least a couple of dozen people went last year. No, I had a bunch of adults go too. But the young people in particular do like it. Because I'm good for treats at Speedway before we head out. So, you know, it's a bribe, but it seems to work. Okay, thank you too much. And we'll let the reader get started with the hours now. Thank you.